The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.
And there's a lot of dialogue like this. We talk about things, but you're starting to see everybody understands there's a sense of urgency to move it into action. And coming here, we were really grateful that within 3 months of my being here, we were able to welcome the Honorable Secretary of War, Secretary Hegseth here, who he was able to give to the region the position and the insights that allies and partners matter, and that America first doesn't mean America alone, and that we need our allies and partners to rise up together. And that implies action.
Aloha, and welcome to Dialogue, where conversations shape security. I'm James Minnick, Colonel United States Army retired and professor here at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies in Honolulu, Hawaii. This is episode 55, Building Advantage in the Indo-Pacific, a conversation with Director Susie Vars-Lum. The Indo-Pacific is not short on dialogue, conferences, working groups, bilateral engagements, and multilateral forums. There's no shortage of coordination, and yet, a harder question emerges. Why do aligned partnerships still struggle to act in concert when it matters most? As the 2026 National Defense Strategy makes clear, the stability of this region depends on more than American power alone. It depends on shared resilience, aligned priorities, and meaningful burden sharing. Without a common threat picture, even well-intentioned actions risk becoming desynchronized. Security breaks down. Not for a lack of engagement, but for a lack of translated action. The challenge is to turn engagement into coordinated decisions and decisions into real-world outcomes. For more than 30 years, DKI APCSS has operated in that space. The Center has recently released its fiscal year 2026 to 2030 strategy. It reflects a shift in emphasis from activity to outcomes, from discussion to impact. Joining me today to explore those questions is Major General retired Susie Vars-Lum, Director of the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies. Her career has been defined by operating at the intersection of strategy, policy, and partnerships. Director Susie Vars-Lum, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you so much, Dr. Minnick. Appreciate being here.
Oh my goodness. I have been waiting for this time to sit down for a very long time. You've been here 15 months. And you're just now coming to sit with us, but it is a good time.
I feel honored.
Oh, my goodness.
Because I've watched your programs as alumna of
the program.
Yes, and I've watched your programs even before I got here. So it's an honor to be here.
Oh, my goodness. So you have a long history. When I think about the, the Army, we use a term, the total Army force.
Yes.
That's the active force, the reserves, and the National Guard. You've served in all three of those components.
I have, and I'm very proud of it.
Over three decades of service, a lot of it here in the region. You've told stories how you started here at the center emptying waste baskets as a private. Is that right?
That's right. 322 Civil Affairs, when the Army Reserve was here before it moved to Fort Shafter Flats. It was all here, where the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center is located, right here.
Oh, that's crazy. And so when I came to the center, it was 10 years ago, I knew of you before you knew of me. You were, at that time, you were a one-star. You're up at the Indo-PACOM headquarters, Pacific headquarters, Pacific Command headquarters at the time. Mobilization assistant.
To the J-5.
To the J-5. You did that. Of course, you're promoted. I think you went on. You were the acting chief staff, the acting deputy commander.
As the mobilization assistant to Admiral Davidson.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
And so you were like, I retired as a colonel. You shot up to two stars. You retired. You went off, and you were the in retirement. You were the president of the East West Center.
Yes, yes, yeah. Extraordinary organization as well.
You have really, really You've got a storied history of engagement in this region. Thank you for that time.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for what you've done.
It's been a good journey for all of us. Start with perspectives before we get into the region. And so, as I mentioned in the opening, you have operated in this intersection of strategy, policy, and partnership. And so what shaped how you think about turning dialogue into real world outcomes?
You know, I think like you, James, where we've seen, you know, all of the challenges throughout decades of experience in the Army, the total force, and then being at the joint force at Indo-Pacific Command for 5.5 years, being able to see all the many challenges and how they've evolved throughout this most consequential region from Hollywood to Bollywood, polar bears to penguins, being able to see, you know, the 38 nations and now 16 time zones, if you include out to Colorado now, it's changing. And there's a lot of dialogue like this. We talk about things, but you're starting to see, everybody understands there's a sense of urgency to move it into action. And coming here, we were really grateful that within 3 months of my being here, we were able to welcome the Honorable Secretary of War, Secretary Hegseth here, who he was able to give to the region the position and the insights that allies and partners matter, and that America first doesn't mean America alone, and that we need our allies and partners to rise up together. And that implies action. And then not long after, you had the Indo-Pacific, you know, the guidance that we got, and as well as the National Defense Strategy that came out recently.
It did.
Gave us very clear guidance with a sense of urgency.
It did.
And that urgency, it made it very clear that what this place was rooted on over 30 years ago, that this place that was expert in convening, it's a natural place for very difficult conversations, that the empowerment piece of this center is the output, and that output needed to happen at a faster pace. So those experiences that we have in the military, the change we're seeing in the geopolitical environment, and the direction that we have gotten from the Department of War and the Secretary has made it very clear that we need to move beyond just dialogue. Education is very important in itself. Connection is critical. Empowerment, even more so, and at a pace at which we need to produce.
You know, it is good, actually, to be recognized as an institution and receive guidance from higher headquarters.
Absolutely.
That has not always been, perhaps, the case, but the meaning that higher headquarters get busy. And the fact that they know you're here, and like you said, the Secretary of War came here, spoke live to the region, it was well received, wasn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. The clarity, the practicality, and the call for collaboration, working together. I often think of the idea of, you know, rather than feed someone a fish for today, but teach a man to fish, or cooperate and help one another in a collaborative way so we can all realize the free and open Indo-Pacific that we all want to see.
So I want to pull a little bit on that, and I want to widen the lens a little bit, talk about the Indo-Pacific environment. And so when you think about gaps in what you were trying to describe needs to occur, what would you say are some of the larger gaps between coordination and security outcomes?
You know, I think there's obviously making sure we understand the security environment, how we see the various challenges, whether it's North Korea or PRC or Russia and the Eastern Military District, whether it's terrorism, whether it's IUU, we all have different perspectives, and we need to understand those perspectives from where we sit. Northeast Asia, Southeast Asia, South Asia, Pacific Islands, the United States, and the U.S. Pacific Islands, and we are a Pacific nation, you know, here in Hawaii, and we know that Guam is at the key critical part of the United States. But that understanding, even in itself, on what's important to every country and where are the synergies to work together, having a common operating picture of what the problem sets are, where the opportunities are to integrate, where are their synergies So therefore, trilateral relationships, where does the Quad or the Squad fit in all of this? Where does AUKUS fit in all of this? You know, understanding all of that and communicating that, and then looking at real world solutions where there are problems. Because I think, going back to that common operating picture, the Pacific is massive.
And
there are many, you know, undersea cables, undersea activities, the more natural disasters that occur in this region. IUU for Pacific Islands. Certainly challenges in unsustainable investments from coercive states or organizations that impact the sovereignty of various nations. Those kinds of things, do we all have a common picture? So everyone's trying to attack the issue, and it may not be coordinated, and therefore we waste resources, waste time. And one good example is, as we're looking at the defense industrial base, which is one of the key lines of effort in the national defense strategy, who's doing what? Everyone realizes that we need to move, and we have moved out quickly here with our multinational armaments resilience seminar.
Yes.
That we are really thrilled. We had our
into the second year of that, is that right?
We are starting the second year. The first year was a success, and that was articulated in the joint statement by the Office of the Secretary of War on March 20th, talking about partners for Indo-Pacific industrial resilience, the Piper Nations. I believe up to 17 now that are part of that, looking at how we can co-innovate, co-create, co-produce very quickly some of the key critical things that we need for the defense and deterrence for our nation and our allies and partners. So we were able to quickly try to look at how do we fill that gap? Well, we can fill that here at this center by bringing people together, by examining where those gaps are and articulating those gaps to our leadership as well as our allies and partners' leadership. And the first iteration, we just finished their initial report of the three different seminars within the MARS program. We called it Multinational Armaments Resilience Seminar, MARS, or Martians. That's a joke, but that report that was fed up to them. Yep. So that they can take a look at, and it can inform higher level decisions at the Piper working group level. And we're looking forward to this next round, and we're grateful for our allies. Australia and Japan stepped up to support us in that. And then this second one, Australia again and the Republic of Korea.
Yeah, no, there's lots to unpack there. You know, just pulling just a minute on the Mars, it reminds, it is emblematic of how quickly the center has been able to adapt and take on what have been missions we hadn't typically done before. And this defense industrial base is not a core mission from previous, but it is an example of the agility with which the center has been able to do these things. Clearly, we know from the national defense strategy that the industrial base is one of the core pillars of the national defense base, and therefore it is. I love the way we have pivoted to that, and I myself have had some opportunities to speak on this to the fellows that have come through. When you were talking about at the beginning of your comments, you're talking about the common operating picture, this threat perspective, as it were. My mind reflected back to over 20 years ago, 22 years ago. I was a policy branch chief at USFK, and we were working with our allies there. And there were several aspects to it, but the very first one, that study we undertook, was this common intelligence assessment to be able to, as allied partners, to collectively agree on what we were understanding as the issue was, which is, certainly, strategy pulls on that. You were pulling on that. Can we understand collectively what we're seeing so we can take cooperative and collective actions? Matters a lot. So I foot stomp what you were pulling on there. So when we think about that, what is it that the center perhaps is trying to change or evolve with regards to our partners as they think, they decide, they act? What do you see? What are we trying to do?
You know, first I have to say that that common operating picture and the challenges are further complicated by disinformation,
of course,
AI, technology, and then quantum computing in the future. As that advances, it is going to change at a rapid pace, and we need to keep up with that. So that sense of urgency. We have had to here at the center, and I'm excited about it, is we established this new strategy that's aligned with the National Defense Strategy that addresses many of these issues on ensuring that we defend the homeland, ensuring that we work with our allies and partners for burden sharing, that we deter threats, and also that we accelerate that defense industrial base. So those lines of efforts clearly in our strategy. Our mission has now shifted to really enhancing deterrence through the core functions that we do that educate, connect, and empower our U.S. ally and partner security practitioners. So very much focusing on that in the Indo-Pacific, not just to talk about, but to solve.
That's right.
And that is the key, to solve. So we enhance deterrence. So we are a critical tool for the Department of War and our allies and partners to address these issues, not just to talk about them.
Yeah, not your spot.
Yeah, yeah. And I think very excited with our lines of effort. You know, our top three are really, you know, allies and partners are all about deterrence. You know, really accelerating change, accelerating solutions through some of our projects and programs. So things that we had in place that maybe were nice to do, now we must do. Nice to do, figuring out a solution to a project for our fellows who come here. And really focusing it on real world problems, whether it is maritime domain awareness, whether it is not having a Coast Guard strategy or a national security strategy or a net assessment or understanding how to integrate and be interoperable at all levels, from the operational to strategic level. These are real world projects that we are now putting resources in, making sure what we do really has actionable outcomes in our signature courses.
I love the way the center has maybe even more refined, in a more refined fashion, approached this in a way that allows it to achieve real results. We have done this for some time with Fellows Projects, which are these longitudinal programs where fellows come here with the area that they want to work on, security perhaps in their own area, but then they come here and they develop an action plan and they go back home and they implement it. But I love the way that we have focused more clearly, and to your point, we've been doing a lot of these things, but are we not now understanding as the environment has changed some, we must really be very clear-eyed about what we're trying to do and then be more helpful in trying to get there. And so as we think through this, we're talking about, you know, this dialogue to action, this nexus that we're talking about. And so when you think about that, I mean, what has to happen to dialogue? And we do a lot of dialogue here. This is dialogue.
That's right.
It is. To translate that into the action that you're talking about. There's some connections there. You want to say more, perhaps?
Yeah. So, you know, first I want to say our strategy, if people can find it online.
Oh, it is.
And you notice the center is the Gordian knot in the Indo-Pacific, the most consequential region with many, many challenges. And it depends on your perspective where you sit. The Gordian knot, of course, in mythology, is that it is almost impossible to undo this knot, but together we can.
Yeah.
With allies and partners, we can. So it is not an impossible task.
So this is an approachable document, front to back, 12 pages.
Yes,
I've
It is approachable. It is.
Say more.
Yes, and you know, it has our mission and vision. It talks about how and why we do what we do. And of course, on the back, it is consumable, but with this, of course, is a longer document the implementation plan. And that implementation plan comes with very specific actions that we need to do. That goes from all the way to who we recruit, that kind of specificity in the Indo-Pacific, and the partnerships that we need that are interagency. And so it's not just uniform military personnel. The beauty of the programs is that we have a variety of perspectives of people in key critical positions who have influence, who become those movers and shakers, change makers. You know, out of the 16,000 alumni we have, over 2,300 have become prime ministers, chiefs of defense, chiefs of their service, yes, ministers. I mean, it's pretty amazing. So we invest at various levels. So we have the up-and-coming leaders. So we want to make sure we recruit that for our comprehensive security cooperation program. And then, of course, our transnational security cooperation program, which is a program I was in 2016. And
I was here.
Yes, you were. You were one of the professors.
Yes.
And, you know, the friendships and relationships I have in there, whether it was a two-star who now became a four-star and now is was a chief of the service of this particular country, and then now is an advisor to the prime minister today while I'm in this job, we stay connected. And that is the beauty, to be able to make that five-minute phone call that took 25 years to develop or whatever, however long. That is the beauty of this program. But it's that kind of specificity, who we recruit, what we put in the programming, and the programming needs to be in the educate portion, those issues or domains of consequence that people need to think about and talk about. So we've moved from just the sage on the stage instruction to the guide on the side, and then also activating our alumni base. So we've gone out throughout the region. I'm so thrilled to have gone with Admiral Paparo, the Indo-Pacific commander, to Nepal and India, even U.S. Army Pacific. A lot of the component commands here in Hawaii, when they go out, they activate and they engage with our alumni, because our alumni are an amazing group of movers and shakers who continue to do great things. Many of them have agreed to be mentors. We have almost 200. I mean, that doesn't seem like a lot out of the 16, but that's still a lot. Considering, you know, we might have 500 move through our programs a year, to be willing to be mentors. So they have all this experience, whether they were ambassadors or non-governmental organization directors or chiefs of defense, and they're retired now, but have so much more to give that they're willing to mentor some of those projects in the longer programs. Whether it is a maritime fusion center, how do you do that with interagency? So it's very methodical. The implementation plan requires that kind of level of specificity so that we can have real outputs. And I'm happy to say that throughout the 31 years of this center, there have been many, many national security strategies, national security policies, defense agreements, bilateral, multilateral defense, trilateral discussions on cyber, projects that deal with new space policy. Yep. That has come from this place. Yes, now we are laser focused on not just, that's like I said, nice thing to do. It's a thing we must do. And that is the fundamental shift in this strategy, is who we're focusing on, who we're bringing in here, what we are doing, how we are doing it. And when they leave this center, that even though it's a short program, it might be a one-year project or two-year project, we still are engaged. And even after that, years later, like myself, you know, 2016, I still remained engaged, because I have to say that this, and not just because I'm the director here, this actually, I have never seen an alumni program as active as this, not to raise money, because I have come from places where you've had to raise money with your alumni. This alumni group is not about that. This alumni group is about activating their expertise, their care and concern, people who have seen conflict, people who understand what happens when we don't maintain peace, and they get it. And those are the people that we need to stay connected with, and they're the ones that need to mentor the next generation so that we can see real results.
We were just in the National Capital Region. We had a course out there, the Mobile Indo-Pacific Orientation course. And we had one of those alumni events, gatherings, and that it is amazing when you put together an event like that, the numbers of people who want to stay, who are connected, that want to come together. I saw one of the fellows that was in a course of mine from many years ago. She was out there, and we reconnected. The senior enlisted advisor, the chairman, SEAC David Isom, was out there. We, in fact, recognized his efforts out there. Work that he did here in building one of the efforts that we're undertaking, the Indo-Pacific Senior Enlisted Leaders Subject Matter Expert Exchange. In June, we'll take it for its third annual year. We'll do it in Brunei. You'll go out there, Brunei. Yes, we'll go out there. We'll engage there. We'll engage in Singapore. Constantly on the road, engaging with people who want to remain connected with us. And you said, well, because I know you just recently started this mentorship program. You said, well, only 200. I'd challenge you to find some other institution that has 200 people in this short of time that stood up and said, let me be a mentor to your program. It is indicative of, and you're not creating networks just so you can have more people on the list, but to do things like you just spoke about.
Absolutely, it's action. And I really want a foot stomp. Thank you for sharing about SEAC ISOM, because you talk about a leader who's not just a security practitioner, but he's a leader who had a vision to partner with us to create that senior enlisted leader subject matter expert exchange, which you're a major part of, and that vision. And, you know, that's pretty historic. When you think about militaries, if you really want to be tip of the spear, be able to deter, when the majority of your force is made up of enlisted personnel, and your ability to translate leadership direction into the force that has to make it happen. He had that vision.
He did.
And really, this is 3 years, and we've been around 31 years, right? So this is the first time, and it was because of him.
Yep.
And which is not surprising to me that he'd become SEAC to the chairman, because he has that kind of vision.
Yeah.
And now, you know, going to Brunei outside of here, I mean, and just the receptiveness of the chiefs of defense in the region to embrace this idea, to build their capacity of their militaries through their senior enlisted leaders and their enlisted force. Is a powerful thing, I think.
I'll push on just a minute more on this. So what was it last week that Admiral Paparo testified? And in his testimony, he called out Sergeant Major Eric Cook, who replaced SEAC ISOM when he was here as a senior enlisted leader. And he didn't just call him by name, but he took a moment to actually talk about the efforts that the enlisted undertake within the command. And so I read that in the testimony as well, and thought that how appropriate it was to recognize the
absolutely enlisted force. And he's sitting right behind him,
right behind
Sergeant
him.
Major Cook.
Yep.
And of course we have a wonderful big display of him.
We do.
Right here. Because they are really
key
primary mission partners, Indo-Pacific Command, to the center.
Yeah.
And we are so grateful that Admiral Paparo and Sergeant Major Cook, they come whenever.
They're here all the time.
They're always here.
Yep.
Addressing and connecting with the fellows from around the region. And even when we, again, like I said, on travel, been able to go with him. And in places like Nepal, where there are 400 alumni and 25%, 100 out of the 400 showed up. That is, I don't know of any other alumni place where 25% show up at one event.
No, and so the reason this is worth foot stomping is because this represents the connection across the region of security practitioners focused on trying to advance security in this region of consequence. This is what the center does. It is amazing, and it is good to be a part of it.
It is. I agree. You know, we, like the other, we're part, one of six regional centers, and all of them have this mission to enhance and support deterrence and through our U.S. ally and partners in whatever region we are. And I'm grateful that we can do that here in the Indo-Pacific.
So having said that, let's take a minute and talk about friction, because it does happen. Even when everyone is aligned and trying from the outset trying mm-hmm. to do the thing, sometimes things do tend to break down, and that usually happens under pressure. And so here's the question: where does cooperation most often fail then? Does it happen because of trust, priorities, execution? Of course, like most things, it's probably a little of all, but still, thoughts.
Yeah, you know, a lot of the issues are very complicated. And as we hear in many of our courses, people have different perspectives, and it's always enlightening to hear that. But at the same time, in the video we show, there's a famous picture where they're sitting around dialoguing, and you see one of the fellows just got their hand in the other person's face because it's clearly you don't understand. We've had traditional two countries in these courses where there's tension along the borders or there's conflict along the borders in the same class at a high level. And because of our non-attribution policy, which has been alive and well for 31 years, that has allowed for honest discussion. And I can recall back even my 2016 class where there were, I was one of two Americans in the class.
Right.
So, you know, certainly challenges or issues that were focused toward me, we could have honest discussions, put the questions on the table, you know, and feel like you could trust me and I could trust you, at least to keep it in this space. And we saw that because of the way in which and the model in which we do these seminars, sessions, chances to talk, chances to engage, and actually chances to do things outside of the academic environment together is a powerful connector. So it's that trust that's built over time while you're here and over time through the connection that we make. So each of the fellows now have chat groups, at least at the time at which WhatsApp chat was created.
I continue to get messages from classes long past gone. They active in it all the time. They can stay connected.
That's right. And then we bring them back here to teach. And we are wanting to bring our alumni back to do more of this kind of dialogue, write pieces, come back and talk to our fellows, create communities of interest, whether it's maritime security, cyberspace, AI, emerging technologies, or interoperability, the comms space. Maybe it's intelligence sharing. There's a lot of communities of interest that we could create. But, you know, sometimes we have to start where we can, but because there is that friction, right? Some people don't want to work together because of some of these historical grievances. But I think it's where we can begin. We should start in the spaces where we can.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, this building of trust, which will matter when the pressure of the crisis occurs, it will depend on largely whether we've been able to have spent time together, been able to work issues like you just spoke about. So years ago, quite a long time ago now, I went to a command staff college with a Korean colleague at the time. He went on, was promoted before he retired to Major General, and Kim Jong-yu is his name. And so. But we were majors at the time, and so this was some time ago. But we spent a year together, and then we kept working together, and I would go to his change, you know, when he took a command, and then one time, he and I were colonels together, and we were counterparts, and we had a real issue to work, and it was because of all that time between then that allowed us to work a real knotty issue with very little problem. And that's the types of things that you're talking about describing here, is that if you've built those relationships when the times are not under stress, you can pull on them when they are. And they increasingly will be. And we will need those relationships.
Absolutely. And I've heard many stories here, not just my old stories, but many stories where partners have had to work together who don't traditionally work together. Whether it was a natural disaster, whether it was, can I enter into that area, but because they knew each other from this course, or calling on another friend from another country because of the courses that they were in, and getting their perspective and advice. Usually in some of these partners, not ones that normally work together or have had traditional historic grievances.
How do you, thinking about what we just spoke about, how do we, you know, balance between creating, you know, this candid dialogue that we're having with advancing the real security priorities? I mean, you started off rightly noting we're not meeting just to get together, but really, and neither are people sending people here just because they did something good before and they want to reward them. They're coming here because we want to be able to advance these real security priorities you talk about. But there still has to be a bit of a balance, perhaps, between the candid dialogue, the leveling of the classrooms that we're having, and yet injecting things that allow us to advance security priorities. How do you think through creating an environment and producing these outputs? How do you think through that?
Yeah, I think because of the complexity of the Indo-Pacific, I mean, if you went around the whole Indo-Pacific, you could find unique challenges, but there are some commonalities where we can work together. And I think we've seen that with illicit trafficking or drug trafficking, IUU, questions on protection of infrastructure, natural disasters, you know, working with, I know you had the Center for Excellence Disaster Management.
We did. We sat down here with Joe Martin.
With Joe Martin. And, you know, he's facing those same things, right? Those commonalities where we can work together. And in fact, we had an alumni roundtable recently in India when Admiral Paparo was there. And a lot of the things that were brought up by the alumni, we were getting insights and perspectives, and many of them said there are common spaces that they'd like to see more of that, where we can work together. Because there is a duality in that, right? If we start to learn how to share information, whether it's in the disaster space, those same structures that allow us to share information would work in crisis.
That's right.
So our ability to do that now and share information, and we see many of the hundreds of exercises that happen in this region under Indo-Pacific Command and the component commands, we want to start to support some of that as well. And that is a sea change for us as well here.
It is, but it's very welcomed, actually. Colleagues feel it welcomed. I think it's being well received amongst the component commands or the combatant command, and it is rather new because I've been here 10 years, and it's been, you know, since you've been here that we've been doing this, and it's a good thing.
It is. It's necessary. Those exercises also help to expose those gaps that you were talking about and what we need to focus on, and then we can come in there and see if we can hone down a little bit more with specificity, bring the right people together, not just do courses here, but maybe workshops out in the region, which we have had just done, whether it's Philippines, Indonesia recently, Singapore, and you know, this is the type of thing that we can bring to the Pacific Islands that we're hoping to go to look at very specific things that we can work, help. What we provide is a resource and scaffolding to bring together the right people, right place, and walk them through the process to achieve the end state, some kind of actionable outcome.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about outcomes. So I might ask you, what do real outcomes look like to you when you think about outcomes?
Yeah, they are either, it's not just, it can be a policy paper, but more things, tangible things that we're looking at is a functioning modernization of a maritime fusion center or a maritime coordination center, information exchange center, a policy or a defense agreement that brings together like the U.S. Papua New Guinea defense agreement or the Papua New Guinea Maritime Fusion Center project that's happening. That will be a tangible outcome, bringing together the interagency to be able to do that. Or whether it's a country's strategy for their Coast Guard, who are facing challenges in their territorial waters. Those are very tangible things that they can use. Or a country that has come here in one of our courses, writing a space policy that doesn't exist. So many of these outputs that inform the direction of a country, many of those things have started here.
So I notice on all those examples you gave, my thoughts were that these were not just single events, but rather they were they continued for some time. They might have started here in thought. They might have been efforts that they were worked here or other places, but they had long connections with multiple events, and these outcomes were almost cyclical in their nature. They were in their creative nature, and so which of course, you know, when we think, which is almost inherent, I guess, in an output. We do a lot of outputs. People graduate, and that was an output. We had a graduation, but the outcomes continue to produce as they go on.
That's a really good point. Yeah. And you know, I like what you're talking about, cyclical, because when I think of the Partners for Indo-Pacific Industrial Resilience, PIPER, the initial workshop started here.
Yes.
A couple years ago, before I got here.
Yes, it was.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
So that started in its initial stages, initial meetings. We got the team here to get that together. Then forming, they said one of the outputs from that PIPER was the recommendation to do the multinational armaments resilience course very quickly. Yeah. And this team here turned it around very quickly, along with our allies and partners helping us out. And then now we're on our second round and really improving it, looking at ways that we can make it better. And you know what's happening out of those outcomes, things that we didn't control? Through the connections are some organic industry, country, bilateral actions that are happening organically. That's not something that we created, but looking at, how could we work together in this particular area, whether it's drones. The idea was to focus on munitions, right? Something that's so critical right now. But that's the beauty of bringing 12 nations or 17 nations and the right people, whether they are assistant secretary for acquisitions from this particular country, who has the ability to make influence and make those decisions, which is the same for those who make decisions for access, you know, whether it's, you know, any kind of access or basing or overflight that countries need. And so we're starting to think in those terms on how can we help one another? And whether it's access basing overflight for natural disasters, a crisis, conflict, and that's not just for the United States, but for our allies and partners in the region.
I like that. So you meet with a lot of senior leaders. They come through the program, you meet with them in your engagements. What should senior leaders do now to strengthen cooperation?
You know, I think there are a lot of things that we have to do, but I think it starts with relationships.
Yeah,
and
being building those now.
It's key to look at the next generation, because this is the long game, right? It's not just the short game, right? The finite, it's the infinite game that we were recently talking about, right? It is, so you have to think about that generational thinking, and that's what we do here as well. We think about that next generation. That's why I like this model of those senior seasoned leaders, who've done so much for security, and they know, they've seen it. And when they get together, it's a powerful thing, even across different countries. What do they have to give back to this next generation that they're grooming? We have to think about that succession planning. We have to think about how do we mentor that next generation that thinks about the issues. What has happened in this region? As we move on, we're starting to forget, right? What happened in this region during World War II. We forget what, so then we shifted from conventional, we went into a Cold War, then went into, for the United States, 20 years of persistent conflict in the Middle East. Whether you were from this region, you were gonna have experience there. And then now, you know, we are looking back at conventional threats, and we have allowed our defense industrial base to certainly nothing like we had seen in the past. And when we look at shipbuilding and ability to produce munitions at the rate at which we need it. There has to be an urgent, fundamental change on the way we're doing things, and I think we can here at the center be a part of that.
No, I couldn't agree more. Before we move over to audience questions, let me ask you this one last thing. As you think towards the future, I don't know, 5 years or so, what does success look like for the Indo-Pacific?
You know, of course, we all say the free and open, that we are free from coercion, that sovereign independent states can enjoy the freedoms just like we do. We defend our homeland. And when we say that America first doesn't mean America alone, we are looking at the sovereignty of all state, respecting the sovereignty of every state.
Yeah.
And then and our homeland is defended. And then, of course, we want to have a place where allies and partners are working together for the common strategic peace, prosperity for the future of the next generation. That's aligned with our values of freedom and openness. And so that's, you know, if we start to see how we work together to address the changing environment, the information environment, and AI technology, that is going to impact us in the next 10 years. It is going to fundamentally change the way, and we're seeing that throughout the world, whether it's Ukraine's impact of using drones. What does that look like for us?
Yeah, the character of conflict and war is changing.
Absolutely.
Without a doubt, fast, quickly.
Absolutely, and we've got to be able to keep up with that pace, not just keep up, but be ahead of it.
Yeah.
And in order to do that, we've got to have those relationships, we've got to have those trusts, we've got to have the ability to maneuver and change the way we're doing things in a more rapid way. So I'm hopeful for that. I believe that it can happen one person at a time. I think the most lethal weapon of any force is our warrior, and we invest in that warrior.
Yeah, we do. We do that here. We have several audience questions, and so we'll turn to some of those. And so this first one's asking us about the alumni network. And so how can the center better leverage its alumni network at the country level, particularly in partnership with U.S. embassies and other partner institutions?
You know, interestingly, we just had a consultant come in and relook. We invested to relook at our alumni base and how we can do things better. So we are looking at a more common platform. While we have WhatsApp, a common platform that would allow these communities of interest. So we have cyber experts in all of these countries.
Yeah.
And they are at different ranges, right, of access to industry, access. So if somehow we can create this community of interest in which we can leverage the technology to be able to interact with one another on a daily basis, whether it's exchange information, create new partnerships, cyber, space, maritime, information sharing techniques, or, you know, the whole range of possibilities. So this is where we want to move, and it is in our implementation plan, in our strategy. So we are going to try to activate that much more outside of just waiting till we come out into the region or waiting till someone does. We want this to be, we can leverage it much more than we are right now, and that's where we want to move towards.
I think that the strength of what we have can be built on, and that is our alumni network. And so I look forward to seeing where this evolves too. This next question is on allies. To what extent does building advantage in the Indo-Pacific depend on sustained alignment with allies and partners?
Yeah, I think we need to look at those areas where it is in our common interests to work together. And so this, for example, at the defense industrial base, the multinational armaments, we looked at those common areas that we can work together, that is in both of our interests to do so. Information sharing, integration, communication. When we look at working together in those exercises, but also in these kinds of real world workshops and projects to identify what is getting in the way, because we have been talking about a lot of these things for a while, right? Even when I was at Indo-Pacific, right? How do we integrate? How do we information share? How do we move forward? But there are real whether they're cultural policy gaps, and we have to be able to identify those and find the right people. Who are the right people that we need to engage in order to overcome them? Yeah.
Hmm. Physical presence, this next question is asking, is what role does physical presence, whether it's such as infrastructure, basing, forward posture, what does it play in building advantage here in the Indo-Pacific?
Well, this is a massive region.
It is.
It's, you know, it's not beam me up, Scotty, to the next country, near X country. It doesn't happen that quickly. We still need to transit a long way, whether it's undersea, on the sea, in the air. You still need a fuel air bridge with the KC-1. I mean, it is vast.
Yeah.
So geography doesn't change. Where we sit, it has not changed. So we know that certain areas where we need to be, we need to have ability to fly, you know, sail and operate wherever international law allows, but we also need our allies and partners to help us out. Also sustainment forward in the region, because it's so vast, being able to leverage our allies and partners to be able to maintain, sustain, be able to produce defense industry parts, to be able to repair forward in the region west of the international dateline. Those are all key critical parts of posture, and that those are critical for us to respond to natural disasters, to respond to crisis, and to deter our adversaries.
You know, as you're listing those, it made me think about an earlier comment you made about how these relationships and these investments of where we are in physical spaces and posture is a manifestation then of how we are working in the steady state to build those relations that we'll call upon in crisis. And I have spent 19, 20 years of my career overseas. And it is because of being there present that we were working together, building those relations.
Absolutely.
And absent that, it would be a lot more shallow, I think, than the types of relationships we build because we have presence.
Absolutely. And you know, and it is the relationships. It's physical presence, not just of, you know, ships, planes, ground forces, but relationships of mid-career, enlisted, senior leaders. I felt very privileged to be able to moderate the Chiefs of Defense Conference in Hua Hin, Thailand, with Admiral Paparo and General Song Wit, then the Chief of Defense for the Royal Thai Armed Forces.
Friend of the center.
You're right, and yes, definitely an honorary alum of the center. You know, when I look at, when I watched their interchange of the relationships that they had, it was really powerful. Not just to hear the dialogue that was going back and forth, but many of them had true, deep relationships. It was almost like the buddy chest bump. And that itself tells you right there that they're on their WhatsApp with each other. They can ask each other. That line of communication is open. Should there be a question, or should they share about their families? You would hear them asking about, I mean, those kinds of things matter.
They do.
And so that when the time of need or an exercise or any kind of response, they're there for one another. And that was very clear to me. And I'm really grateful that I got to be a part of it and see it.
This next question is asking about regional risk. So how do you assess rising tensions across the Indo-Pacific, and where do you see the greatest risks to coordination?
You know, I there are many, and it depends, of course, which region that you're looking at, and you have different stages. And I think certainly when we look at within the South China Sea, there Taiwan. There's certainly miscalculation that could occur, that definitely a risk of escalation. There are also risks on misunderstanding and inability, should allies and partners have to respond. I think the risk of getting the right picture. I think there's a lot of risk in the disinformation and in communications, the role that artificial intelligence plays, and our inability to be ready to look at this new sort of triad that I've heard is, you know, AI, emerging tech, and space. So those three go down. Do we have redundancy in the ability to respond in a variety of crisis and conflict? There's certainly risk in that, and I think we need to do more to reduce that risk, and we do that by working more closely with our allies and partners on real concrete steps. And I think it's sort of like the next stage. So these exercises have gotten more complex, and they're wonderful. Yeah. From the time that I was at Indo-PACO, I see it now, and I'm like, wow, we've got more countries in there. It's not just a bilateral exercise. You've got multilateral. And that having that multilateral allows you the ability to reduce that risk, mitigate that risk. Not to say that those are not going to be there, but the more that we can do, like you said before, crisis conflict, or natural disaster response, the more that we can do, we will be much more, you know, even more prepared.
Hmm. Let me ask one more question of this set. This one's asking about smaller states. So how can smaller states position themselves to benefit from and contribute to security cooperation here in the Indo-Pacific?
I think there is so much. The more that small states, particularly, you know, I mean, for example, Pacific Island nations, you know, small, but I say small island states, big ocean states.
Yes.
So their ability to contribute and cooperate with one another for maritime domain awareness to prevent IUU, that the key critical Pacific gold, or the tuna, 60% of our U.S. tuna comes from the Pacific Ocean. The minerals that exist in their waters, their territorial waters, and exclusive economic zones. You know, they may not feel like they have those resources, but together, when you think about entities like working together in the Pacific Island Forum,
there's a lot of strength from working together,
right? Or ASEAN working together, right? Or you know, South Asian countries working together in the huge, vast Indian Ocean. I think there we go back to collaboration. There we go back to one another. There we go back to really finding real solutions by bridging, and I think that's what we can do here at the center. Mm.
Before I let you go, you know, you and I were talking before the show started, and tell me about the book you're reading.
Yes, this is one that I heard from Admiral Paparo's reading list, and I'm so glad he made this recommendation. But it's the U.S. Army, and not just because I retired from the U.S. Army, but U.S. Army in the...
Well, that is a good reason.
It is a good reason. In the Pacific War, 1941 to 1943, it's Fire and Fortitude by John McManus. And it is fascinating because, you know, geography, like I said, in the Pacific, it matters. And it doesn't change... Yeah. Where we sit here in Hawaii, and you know, it starts there, and you look at Guam, Saipan, Iwo Jima, you look at all of the South Pacific Islands, Australia, New Zealand, all in the Pacific in their role, Northeast Asia, all of that is in this book. And of course, I was very proud of the fact that although a lot of people, and I love, of course, our Marine brothers and sisters, but they often are thought about in the Pacific. But actually, if you look at the raw numbers of the amount of logistics and sustainment that went through the Pacific during World War II, we have much to learn from it. Mm-hmm. I think when you talk about geography, risk, all those questions that were asked, I think this is a great book to read. And very insightful about when we look at the importance of the Pacific in what we're facing today.
So I want to read this book. I read a lot, as you know. I read all the time.
I know you do.
I've not read this one. But as you were talking, Susie, my thoughts went back to my senior year in high school. And so I had one of my teachers, George Straley, he taught social science. And I remember, it was a long time ago for me, but he fought on Bougainville. And he shared stories. Maybe you couldn't do it today, but I remember a lot of the war stories we talked about then, and it shaped a lot of my thoughts. And so I have no doubt that because of the Pacific, that campaign will be in here as well. And so fond thoughts of George Straley, and I will read this as well. Thank you for coming on Dialogue and to have this conversation with the audience, and it was really wonderful.
Thank you so much, James. I appreciate it. And I thank everyone for dialing in.
Yeah. Well, we will reach out to you to have you out again. Hopefully it won't be 15 months before you come back on the show.
Thank you.
As we conclude today's dialogue, this conversation reminds us the distance between a strategy document and a security outcome is measured in trust and shared understanding built long before a crisis. It reinforces that our mission is not merely to convene, but to turn dialogue into the coordinated decisions and concrete actions that are required to sustain a free and open Indo-Pacific. These conversations shape security. On behalf of all of us at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies, thank you for joining us for this important dialogue. Many thanks to Director Susie Vars-Lum for her insights. I'm James Minnick, and until we meet again, aloha. The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.